here.
It is Super Fucking Tuesday. It's Super Tuesday, and we're here. We're back. We've got some things to break down for you in just a bit. I'll be joined with co-host Adam Morrow. I am editor-in-chief at the Alabama Take, playing Duncan. First, a bit of housekeeping. I want to remind you to subscribe to us if you haven't already. If this is your first time listening, subscribe to us. Why don't you? With plethora of television shows. It's nice to have some folks like us at Taking It Down to help you sort through it all. So jump on with us. Check out the Alabama Take website. It's where it all began. There's writing on there that we can't get to in some of these podcasts. But we're going to get into today's episode, being joined today by Adam Morrow in just a second. Yeah, so we're back with Adam. Adam, I know you might be a little upset over Tom Steyer dropping out of the race.
I'm trying to wait my turn, make it to Super Tuesday, get my vote thrown in there, and then he just drops out. What billionaire can I vote for now? I don't know.
I guess Bloomberg, right?
I guess he's got to be my guy.
You really want the guy with the most money. That's who.
I mean, it's
that's who you want to vote for.
He's the smartest guy, clearly.
So you and I, this is not a political podcast, just for, if you're a first-time listener. You and I are going to give our thoughts on the Amazon Prime show, Hunters, in just a, that's a later segment that's coming up. Before we get there, let's just talk TV in general. Tell me what's been happening at the Morrow House on television.
Well, you know, we're still, and we're going to get into this too. It's impossible for me to think about TV at the moment and not think of The Outsider. That show is top of the heap.
Would you say it's possessing you?
Yeah. It's always in my head. I got a little itch to find out more, but, you know.
Absolutely. You don't have an itch to wear a mask and eat kids, do you?
Maybe help a guy who does. I don't know. Yeah. I don't want to shut anything down, you know? Why close a door?
So, yeah, we're going to get into The Outsider just a little bit. We tend to touch on it. This podcast is not an outsider podcast, but that's the predominant show. What? Anything else you've been watching, though?
I mean, I'm still watching McMillions. I'm sure that we'll keep getting into that.
I do want to touch on McMillions in just a second. Another HBO show, and we're HBO stands, obviously. But there's a couple other things I'll get to that aren't HBO related. But continue.
Well, staying on HBO, High Maintenance has still been good. It's one of those. We talked about this on the last pod that kind of maybe gets overlooked at times. And it's such it's such a clever show. I never am frustrated by watching it. It's like. You know, it's like people talk about exercise. Like, you're never in a worse mood than when you started. You know, it's just like a good little bite-sized kind of short story-esque thing. Yeah, it's been good this season.
Did you watch the most recent one that aired on Friday night?
No, I haven't. Okay. I caught the one where they go to the karaoke bar with his jury team, right? He has jury duty. And, of course, my friend. Yeah, I thought that was a great setup.
I thought that was one of the weakest episodes I've seen, though. I will say that.
Of that show, really?
Mm-hmm. I did, yeah.
I was just tickled so much by the thought of him partying with his fellow jurors. Like, that, just the concept alone maybe kept me in it longer than it should have. But, yeah
that was that. That was a good concept. The episode as a whole, just I wasn't as invested in for various reasons. But the one that aired Friday night, I thought it was about to get too clever for its own good, but it turned out it was a good episode. So I'll be interested to hear what you think. Once you watch it, you should let me know.
I will. Yeah. Friday kind of turned into a hunter fest at the Morrow House. So, which we'll get into.
Yeah. That second segment, we're going to deal with Amazon Prime's show, Hunters. A quick thing that I noticed last night pop up in a commercial I thought I'd bring up today. So FX on Hulu is happening on March the 2nd. And I know a lot of people who have Hulu who may not even have like a cable or satellite subscription. And I just...
That's me.
Yeah, that's you. And so I wanted to let you specifically and then others, our listeners, know that there's some good stuff on there. Like What We Do in the Shadows, which aired last year. It's a good 30-minute show, 22-minute show, probably with commercials taken out. And that was good. It was pretty funny. Baskets is a really great show. Again, 22, 23 minutes, and it has such pathos behind that comedy. It is it's a pretty deep show at times, but wonderful. And then Atlanta will now be on Hulu, and I think it might have already been on there anyway.
It has been.
Okay, so but the FX on Hulu sounds promising, and I think that Hulu is also going to be putting shows specifically on there. Like they won't be on FX at all, but they'll be on FX on Hulu.
FX is getting into the streaming game via Hulu.
Right. Okay. All owned by Disney, by the way. All of that's owned by Disney.
Ugh.
Yeah, but that, like, I think that's where Disney's going to develop their more adult shows, if that makes sense.
Who could have guessed that, because I'm assuming that FX means that It's Always Sunny will now be readily delivered to Hulu?
I mean, it already, that's a good question.
But just thinking about where FX was 15 years ago and where that show was is kind of like an anchor of sorts for them, and now it's all owned by Disney. How strange.
Yeah. Which a lot of people complain about, and I get it, but you know, it doesn't bother me. You know, FX on Hulu sounds like a pretty good possible idea for things. So yeah,
it is always kind of you're trying to figure out, is this a good thing to deepen the pockets of people doing interesting things? Like, mm-hmm. especially with streaming, it seems like we've talked about this in the past, especially with our decade in review, just the idea of streaming services coming out and people realizing that risk aren't the worst thing. They're less risk averse, I guess I would say. So I don't know. Maybe, mm-hmm. maybe you're right. The Disney money flowing into the right hands could be cool.
Yeah, but it's caused, you know, this overload of shows that are airing now, by the way, just all across networks and streaming services. I stayed up pretty late last night just to catch up on some shows, and I feel like that's going to become like a weekly thing for me. I'm currently watching several shows, juggling shows in the air. High Fidelity on Hulu, I'm watching.
What do you think
of that? Oh, I recommend it. Yeah, it's good. Have you watched it?
I haven't yet. I've seen very mixed opinions floating around. I was curious about
your take. Quick.
Yeah,
I'll do a quick take. So it's Zoe Kravitz playing the role of Rob. If you're familiar with the High Fidelity movie or book, Rob was a guy, but in the show, she's Robin Rob. And it's showing a side of Zoe Kravitz that I don't know that I've seen ever. She's usually so muted in so many of her things that she's done, the two or three things I've seen her do. She's very muted. Muted's the word I'll use. But here she's getting to show so many more emotions, and I think it works. It's certainly entertaining and funny. So we're about halfway through High Fidelity, and I give it a thumbs up. It's good stuff. I'm going to rattle off a few shows that I'm trying to juggle, and you chime in and let me know if you've watched any or what you think, or if you have questions. So we got Briar Patch on USA. We've got this really weird show on Apple. Well, it's not even that weird. It's called Mythic Quest : Raven's Banquet. And that sounds like a stupid title, and they're playing on the stupidity of that title.
Okay.
That's kind of, that's created by Charlie Day, and it stars Rob, give me his name here, Rob.
Yeah.
From It's Always Sunny. Oh, gosh. McLarnery or whatever his name is.
Rob McDonald.
Rob McDonald. Yeah, Ronald McDonald. Anyway, he's on that show with several other people, good actors. And it's about a company who produced like this Skyrim kind of game, and they're dealing with a public online community, you know, saying this game sucks and when are you going to add more to it? And that sounds very niche, but it's pretty funny, pretty good show. I'm also watching Kidding on Showtime, the Jim Carrey show, Avenue 5, which we talked about last time, Curb Your Enthusiasm, you and I talked about that last time, and also Better Call Saul started back up, which is outstanding, just so good.
I've got to get in on that.
Are you caught up though?
No, not even a little bit. I think we talked about this last time, but it's like knowing You know, if you get a meal sometimes and you leave the best thing sitting there on the plate for a little while, like I know that it's out there and I know that I'm going to dive in and love it at some point. But like we've touched on, there's so much going on right now. I don't know. The universe will provide a time for me to watch Better Call Saul. And I'm not sure that I've hit it yet. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I've heard people say that show actually might work a little bit better as a binge. And I can see that because we were catching up on it last night and I was thinking to myself, okay, that character is mentioned in Breaking Bad, but I can't remember how or why. So a binge might work well for Better Call Saul.
Interesting. See, I thought that Breaking Bad was a great episodic, especially in the last couple seasons or however they ended up breaking that up, you know, having to sit and think.
Mm-hmm.
Each week.
And Saul, Saul definitely fits that mold, but as far as trying to keep up with who is who and when they were called back on, or they're being used as callbacks from Breaking Bad. Yeah, I think just the memory thing. And, you know, there's our pals over at McMillions that's about to wrap in the next couple episodes. A big shout out to Frank Colombo. That's our online buddy.
He's our pal. He liked and he commented. That's so cool. Frank, please come on the show. I have questions.
Yeah, Frank, if you're listening, Frank, reach out to us or we can reach out to you. So Frank Colombo on McMillions. Just let's spend a minute or two on McMillions if you want.
Yeah.
Are you down?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it continues to garner my attention because it's subverting the usual crime story, because there's this guy who you think is the crime boss, and I'm putting air quotes around crime boss, but he wasn't. Like, he was like a underling to like this guy in Georgia, this southern dude, Florida, Georgia person.
A lot of a bait and switch, and not in a manipulative way. I'm not using that as a derogatory term at all.
That's just how the story plays out.
Yeah. And they do a really good job of, I feel like sometimes documentaries, when they sit down to put the whole thing together, that person or that team already knows all of the information, and a really good, especially episodic documentary, makes you feel like you're learning things along with the team. You know what I mean? So, and this is like, you're there with them the whole time, and they cut it together in the right way so that you really are in the moment with them, I guess.
And there's this added bonus that they have nearly all of the participants in this crime on camera talking about this twisty saga.
Which I have so many questions about. Like how they got those people who were admitting to crimes, or to at least being, you know, party to a crime. Like, were they, I mean, I guess they're going to answer these questions eventually. Did those people go to jail? Did anything happen to them? Did some of them only speak after a statute of limitations had expired? I mean, what?
Yeah.
And I'm sure they're going to answer all of these questions.
They're going to have to.
Two episodes. But I'm with you. It went from a fun look at how somebody might rig the McDonald's game, which they answered that question by the end of episode two, like the mechanics, the distribution of the tickets, all of this kind of stuff. And it becomes very, very human, because you have these people looking and saying, oh, I can win $1 million. But after these shady dudes take their cut, after the government, you know, gets their taxes out of it, it's not that much money. And there's a bunch of scenes where people are, you can see it in their eyes, like trying to figure out, or they were trying to figure out, I've become involved in something way bigger than me and it wasn't worth it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's a very human story.
It is. And that also makes it compelling. It hit me last night. I was watching one of the episodes last night, I guess the most recent one, and it's just a continual lesson, or it's really building this thematic thing that how hard it is to turn down money. You know, you got one in the most recent episode, there's this one winner who hasn't been on camera before. I think his name's Greg. He's from South Carolina or Georgia.
Walhalla, South Carolina. I have a cousin that moved there.
Okay. Well, there you go. And this guy, he's shown on his farm singing, a very patriotic song. What was the song? America?
America the Beautiful or God Bless America, something like that.
Yeah, and it was just such a direct connection to capitalism. And I think he was doing this very unironically. It's almost infuriating to me at the because of these themes. It's just this idea that we have to have $1 million in order to be considered successful. Like making $300,000 a year isn't good enough, or making $500,000 a year isn't good enough. I've got to make $1 million, and then I got to have another $1 million. Having a BMW in the driveway just doesn't cut it. I have to have a boat. Did you get that impression, or did it have that effect on you?
That scene in particular, he's singing because he thinks the cows like it. He's feeding the cows. Like, oh, they love it when I sing. He's such a brash guy with a lot of confidence, but as you kind of discover his story, like a handful of these people, not coming from the best background, and people that they trusted offered them this leg up. And you start to think about, you know, you talked about capitalism and it's kind of how it rears its ugly head on the top end of, I already have so much, but I just want more. Well, the people underneath the wheel are these people who, like the single mom, this guy trying to kind of get his life off on the right foot, who have to depend on this chance game that this guy has rigged through a company that sells food that is profoundly bad for you. It's just like a snapshot of America, and not the most flattering one.
No, it's not. And then how great was it to find out that Michael Hoover, who you met in the first episode, he was like the original guy that they helped them start working backwards. You know, they sort of allowed him to win because they were monitoring the game at this point. By they, I mean the FBI was monitoring the game at this point. He's kind of stupidly helped the FBI get started on cracking this down. He was such a goober and utter fool. But how great was it to find out he was a drug dealer? It was hilarious because he was just like your goofy, stupid uncle, and he was just cheesing for the camera and saying, "Well, I bought a magazine, and here it is. And I lost my magazine on the beach."
He wanted to,
and you're thinking, "This guy's a buffoon."
Yeah.
And then he turns out to be this drug dealer,
which is
hilarious.
How did he? Maybe he did do time for anything drug related at some point, but it's like this guy invited a camera crew into his house and then took them around for a day, showing them his fraudulent.
And he's grinning like a fucking possum.
Yeah,
you know?
He's having a blast. And I did think it was funny that they said that he was, one of his friends said, you know, he's just always a happy-go-lucky kind of, nothing really bugging him kind of guy. It's like, yeah, this guy sounds great, except he's dealing drugs. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, what is going on?
And then we have the guy who says, who's quoted, I don't think he ever appears on screen, but he says, he finds out about the ticket thing or the McDonald's little ticket, and he says, I'll take two or three of them. And he was already described as a high roller. It's like, Jesus Christ, come on.
Yeah,
how much
the guy
do you
going
need?
Through the divorce, they said, right?
Yes.
I thought the Frank's nephew, his reveal, that was all good. I thought it was some very emotional moments there.
It was.
And I think Frank, buddy, you're crying on screen. I mean, as anyone would, that was such a touching moment of, you know, there is a goofiness to this particular crime story because it is McDonald's and it's, you know, just all these, the people are funny. They're all good on camera. We talked about that, but
absolutely
just that moment where it's like, no, this is real life. And he grounded that really well. I don't know. I just admire his, anybody being that open about a fan. I can't imagine the context of like talking about all that stuff.
Yeah. And I had a feeling a couple episodes ago that, either Jerry Colombo had died or was in prison. I knew something was, we were going to get a reveal on something. So that was kind of a sad moment.
That was one of the questions that we had kind of along with, how are these people talking about this crime? How did they ostensibly get away with it, or they've already served whatever has passed in the last 20 years. Where the other thing was talking about the two Jerrys in the past tense, or them never being on camera. And one of those questions, I guess, is still up in the air. But yeah, mm-hmm. Jerry Colombo, it is a sad ending.
So it's got two more episodes. By the time you hear this, our podcast episode, a new one would have aired. So one more episode. And we might return to that. It's a good documentary, and it's been very entertaining.
Highly entertaining. But, one of the better HBO docs like this that I've seen in a while.
Yeah, I think so too. And a lot has to do with those characters. Yeah, you're right. So maybe because it's the best show airing right now, we've gotten in the habit of talking about The Outsider, and we'll pick back up with that briefly. I think you got more thoughts on this most recent episode than I. So why don't you get us going?
Well, this was... We talked about the phases of the show. I guess you can think of most of these kind of self-contained 8 to 10 episode series as having acts. You know, the first act, you introduce this idea. Second act, mm-hmm. you try to substantiate it. They're usually lost in the woods, metaphorically, most of that time. And then they set up action for the last bit of it. And last time we talked about how episode 6, I guess, would have been the most recent one. How they, everything hinged on Holly being able to convince this group of people, some of them spiritual believers, some of them totally, you know, fact, kind of tactile understanding of the world, that the thing that has been causing all of this pain and suffering is essentially the boogeyman. Mm-hmm. So now there's no more question about that for us as viewers. Like, we've seen, we have all of the evidence. They have all of the evidence. Now they've seen a crime attempted to be committed, I guess, and they've set this trap to make sure that Claude, the guy who El Cuco has assumed the identity of, they keep eyes on him at all times to confirm that he's not in two places at once. And it looks like they have caught this thing. And the whole thing, really, since we last talked, has been tracking, does Ralph believe in what's happening or not, the detective.
Mm-hmm.
I saw one person comment, who is the outsider? Is it Ralph or is it El Cuco?
That's a good question. I like that question. I like when shows are able to present those kinds of questions where you take for granted going in that the outsider is going to be the monster, the guy in the shadows there for several episodes in the beginning, and then turns out it could very well be Ralph or maybe even another character or two. I feel as the show has about two or three more episodes at this airing, probably two more episodes, and I feel like it's got a little bit more to reveal.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there were moments, I texted you about this, not to get too down the rabbit hole about this, about the, I guess, the logistics of how El Cuco works, but they lingered on Claude's hands a lot in that episode. Was that, you didn't notice that?
I didn't pick up on it until you talked about it, and my memory kicked in, and I did think about it a little. What did you ever come up with, or what were your thoughts on it?
I mean, I don't want to go too far down the, like, a Reddit thread or something, but he's got tattoos on his hands, and, you know, there's a, like with Terry Maitland, it seems like there was a window where El Cuco really looked like Terry, and that's when he committed the crime. Mm-hmm. Like, he was going mm-hmm. to look the most like the imitation can look, and then it starts fading away. And there's got to be, I mean, maybe they're not going to go for a cheesy moment where both Claudes are in the same place, you know, and they have to tell a difference, or they have to
like a Scooby-Doo
yeah,
moment.
Yeah, like that would be very Scooby-Doo. But you do wonder if Claude is going to somehow get separated from the group, and they're going to have to prove that he's not, you know, blah, 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 all this stuff. But they kept showing Claude's hands. There's a long shot when he's in the jail cell being held for his own protection. He doesn't know that yet. And there's a camera slider kind of action thing very slow, and his hands are sticking through the bars, and you get a real strong look at him. And then there's one of El Cuco at the end eating that whatever he's eating, just ripping it apart, and you see Claude's hands again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to notice any, like, I went back and looked, and the tattoos are kind of more faded on Claude, and they're a little bit more vibrant on El Cuco. I don't know. Thinking back now, there have been a lot of scenes where his hands are prominently featured. I don't know if that means anything or if I'm really lost in the weeds there.
You got to think it does. This feels like a very purposeful show, a well-done show, and that they're going to show you something for a reason. So
the other thing that I kind of perked up at was how often the span of years, 14 to 15 years, came up in the last episode. The first time that it
comes tell
up,
me more about this.
And I have no theory on what this means. But, you know, Ralph tells that story about his son being born and him driving alone right after it, running an errand, and talking to his mom out loud, who had died 15 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the song that he had not heard since she died, the last thing that he played for her, basically before she died, right after she died, he played the song, and he hadn't heard it since then. It starts playing on the radio out of all the songs that could have played. So he says that's been 15 years. Do you remember the fellow's name? Not the lawyer, but the guy that he has the conversation with?
Alec.
He's
the PI guy?
Yeah. He says that when Holly asked who all wants to volunteer and go get Claude or watch him,
right,
he said, it tasted like there were pennies in my mouth. And I haven't had that since I was in Iraq 14 or 15 years ago. And then the last one that I can recall, I'm assuming that's the grandparents of the two kids, right?
Yes, that's what I assumed, who were taking them to the cave of Palooza, the cave stock, whatever it was.
Cave Fest.
Cave Fest.
So they, when they get there, he says something about, I think 15 years is, you know, I'm over this. I'm over coming to this. So I don't know, that's a lot of, you know, if you think about, if you're creating a fictional story, you would probably not use the same time span over and over again in these kind of different stories and setups. I don't know. Do you make anything of that?
I don't, but I'm glad you brought it up, because now I can keep my eye out for it, and we can watch to the end and figure out if it's going to call back to that, or maybe it's just supposed to be coincidental in a way that some of the other text is a coincidental.
El Cuco works in cycles, right? That's the mechanism, is that they can generally say every 20 or whatever X number of days, he's going to attack and have to eat. So time has already been shown to be a factor in these cycles and blah, blah, blah. So who knows? I mean, regardless, we're headed for a showdown. Somewhere in the caves, probably.
Absolutely.
So, and I thought it was the next week on segment after the episode, they asked the question, can it be killed? You know, that's kind of like the last question of how has, in all of human history, a bunch of folks from Georgia are the first ones to trap it in a cave. Like, can it die? What happens if it can't? And they're all down in the cave with it. We're going to find out.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, it's so timely, because the same could be said about Michael Bloomberg's campaign.
Yeah.
You know,
it's really a direct reflection of of our political process here.
And one thing I was really proud of the show for doing is that there was a very slight dip. If I'm reading this on sort of a bar graph or something, there was a dip for me when the Jack's mother shows up as the monster took the form of Jack's mother. Yeah. That was it felt a little off compared to the rest of the show. But when the monster El Coco, the grief eater, whatever you want to call him, is sort of physically present in the car with Jack, and he's eating the deer, I think it is, the animal we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
It, that did not dip. That suddenly was, it felt realistic and it felt very scary. It felt like the tone hadn't changed, which I felt the show was doing a good job of, because that was pretty creepy. And when it talks, there's, it's still maintaining that thrilling, scary vibe, I think.
Even, I guess, maybe the most overtly it's a monster moment outside of the eating was when he's in kind of soft focus and Jack is in the foreground, and it's in human form and has already spoken with a human-esque voice, and then it just starts its screaming thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that was an intense episode. It was a frightening episode in a good way.
Yeah. So I bet we're gonna touch on The Outsider once more.
Yeah, we have to wrap it up now.
I think so. Yeah, we've been tracking it, so that's more to come on that one. We're gonna take a quick break here, and we'll come back in a little bit. Okay, as you know, our podcast is part of the Alabama Take Network of podcasts, which includes pods like Picks in a Parking Lot. That's exclusive only to the Alabama Take website. You can also find the Alabama Take podcast itself. It's called The Alabama Take. You can find that on any provider for podcasts. Go find Corey Hanna talking to the best and brightest in our world. As for any and all Alabama Take happenings, we post and reply with regularity on all social media as well as our website. Check us out. Coming up is our discussion on the newly released Amazon Prime show, Hunters. Okay, so yeah, we're back. We're talking Hunters, Amazon Prime, starring, biggest name is Al Pacino, but we've got Josh Radnor and Logan Lerman is probably the protagonist, the main guy. He plays the young guy, Jonah. And what's the show about? You want to give us a overview to get us going?
Sure. Yeah. I don't know if you want to get into the inciting incident yet, but it is quickly revealed that there are still Nazis in America in 1977, or not still, they have come to America between the end of World War II and 1977 and learned to blend in at various levels of society. Some are pretty prominent government officials it sets up early on, and some less so, but there is also a network of these Jewish folks who have decided after, you know, they would be at the market. I think this was kind of what kicked it off, right? They're at the market and this woman realizes that the guy buying cantaloupes down the aisle is a Nazi concentration camp director or doctor or something. She recognized this guy as this, you know, one of the most evil people that has ever lived, and he's just at the grocery store living life like a normal dude. So they decide that revenge is needed, justice. So they form this organization that's basically hunting down former Nazis.
Mm-hmm. Headed up by Al Pacino's character, Meyer. And they kind of rope in the young guy, Jonah. He's sort of our audience perspective. He's our audience point of view character. Jonah is, he seems to be, what is he, 19, 20, 21, something like that?
Figure out if he's in college or high school, but definitely, yeah, like right around 20, give or take.
Okay, so the story picks up pretty quickly with him, and his grandmother, who is a concentration camp survivor, Holocaust survivor, she is assassinated there in his home, and he's upstairs and catches a glimpse of this happening, and that sort of gets the plot in motion, where he meets Meyer. Meyer comes to the funeral proceedings and almost gets recruited by him in sort of a way. Anyway, they cross paths more than that, not to give too much away. And he kind of gets roped into this group of hunters, these Nazi hunters, hence the title. And it's almost like a super group or like an FBI or CIA agency kind of group, though they're not. and they all have their specialties, and they're hunting down these Nazis kind of almost one by one, and taking care of what the law maybe didn't back in 45, 46, 47, just after World War II. So let's get into some of the more specific stuff. I have watched the first three episodes.
I'm two in at this point.
Okay. So what? Give me some generalized thoughts that you had watching.
You know, the first episode, it's not as clear that it's almost headed in a comic book kind of direction, or
right,
comic book, a graphic novel kind of vibe. And it's a lot of it is just, I mean, it's an hour and a half long. That's a lot of story to take in, and it felt like a cinematic kind of world unfolding. A lot happened. It's heavy. It's not, I think maybe my favorite thing so far about the tone of the show is, you know, Nazis are almost the stand-in for, like, we can all agree that they needed to be killed, right? It's not like a shades of gray, like that was a black and white kind of war. That's how we like to view that. Even though his grandmother has been killed, he watched her be killed by these Nazis. It's still a lot of moral ambiguity that he's working through. And I think that has been the strong suit of the show so far for me.
I have a lot of issues with the show. I don't know if I'm a fan. And I can get into some. I'll rattle several off. So I feel like this show, I'm having trouble with it playing the evil to a somewhat comedic effect. It's the evil on this show is kind of fluctuating. At times we're meant to be shocked by it, and I feel like at other times it's Tarantino-esque in how it's presented.
Yeah, that does make sense. I mean, there are scenes of super tense, like you're saying, Tarantino kind of thing, and there's moments where it's like they're making jokes about Germans that kind of just fall flat.
Yeah. It feels like a show that didn't gel into what it wanted to be, one way or the other. Like, it should have gone full, you know, in that vein of Tarantino, where things are just a little goofy, a little off, a little alt history, even. But, or it should have been a very serious look at this historical thing. I think some of this is based in history, where there was a Jewish collective of people who were tracking down Nazis, right, after the war?
Yeah, I mean, there was a whole agency for that, right, based in Israel, that I guess Argentina is kind of the famous, like, if you want to joke about, oh, he's this German guy that lives in Argentina now that did pretty well for himself, it's like, the joke is, yeah, there's a Nazi living in South America. But, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, they would find these people, drag them back to courts. They have kind of an impromptu courtroom that they use in the show. I think the conviction has already been handed down, but yeah. It is based in such a thing that is seared into our collective memory that it feels very real.
I would have liked for it to either gone a fairly historical route or gone 2 feet in with the absurdity that they're trying. They want to fluctuate between the two, and it's just not working for me.
It's kind of coming across lukewarm to you.
Yeah, very much. Al Pacino, he isn't phoning it in by any means, but I feel like he just doesn't have anything to do other than go to a place and give instructions.
That's kind of his MO, isn't it? That's his role.
Yeah.
Well, one, bankrolling it, and two, just being the guy in charge.
And you were talking about the first episode being pretty cinematic, and it was an hour and a half long, but it felt as if it was holding back so much story at the introduction of the team should have taken place for me about three-fourths of the way through episode one, but instead that's in the first 15 minutes of episode two.
Yeah, that was an interesting decision, I thought. I don't know. I guess you're a little bit further into it than me. I do have issues with, like you're saying, with them defining the bad guys in the show and how that's going to work. I don't know. I mean, episode two hints at this woman who seems to be running things. for the Nazi side. I'm sure that they are going to expand upon that probably in episode 3. So I was going to reserve judgment on that and just try to talk about the good, but hey, I'm here for your questions on this show.
Okay, so it was episode 2. Correct me if I'm wrong, and this isn't a spoiler even if I am wrong, but it's episode 2 where we get this African-American federal agent. She's an FBI agent. She's right. Kind of starting to unravel some of the mystery behind these Nazis existing, right?
Right, she is, based on a woman being killed in Florida who had an association with NASA.
Mm-hmm, who turns out she was a Nazi, so she was gassed in her own bathroom. So,
how'd you like that bait and switch on the nudity warning at the beginning of the episode? Not what you thought it was it?
That yeah that got me, I'll admit. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be. You're right. So we get this African-American FBI agent. She's down in Florida. Was this the scene where she's knocking on the front door and she yells across the street?
Yeah.
Is that in episode 2?
I think good. yeah.
So this is a good example of how the show, it's so minor, but it's a good example of how the show wants to be Tarantino-esque at times, but it falls flat. So she yells across the street. Somebody tells her to stop knocking so loudly, and she yells, you know, I'm already cranky. I'm in Florida. And that line didn't register a smile with me. It just felt like something someone would not say at her level and as an FBI agent. Instead, I think they wanted that to be funny, and it just wasn't. And that line would have played so differently in a Tarantino movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there's a lot about her character. Maybe these things improve, but I don't know. Like, you want to root for her. She's clearly agitating the people around her, probably because it's 1977 and she's an ambitious woman, black woman. The reason she's in Florida is that the guy at the New York office doesn't want to deal with her and sends her down there. There's just a lot of cliches kind of over and over again with her that I feel like she is, the actress was not dealt an easy hand on these first couple episodes.
Yes. And it's not even the show's not even a full procedural, because we don't even get this shot of Jonah, who happens to read a piece of paper that's written in code, and he figures out the code. And it's not established how they take that code and go find this hiding German, Carl Hofstetter or something like that. And they find him, they track him down to be like this music producer, and he's going by an Americanized name. And they track him down, but we don't get that information. It's just...
Well, the address and the letter, right?
Right, but it just seems as though there were more steps to have taken. And I want to compare that to something like Better Call Saul would have shown you, or Breaking Bad, take your pick, would have shown you some of those steps, and not only shown you those steps, but made those steps fascinating and interesting and compelling.
Yeah, I'll definitely agree with that, that they were, I don't want to call it lazy writing, but if you get a little too excited to get to what's clearly going to be an entertaining scene, which is the confrontation with the Nazi, and you kind of blow right past the details of that, where other shows would make the details interesting, like you're saying. Yeah, I get what you're saying here.
And I do have problems with the Lonnie Flash character, played by Josh Radnor. He's better known for How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah, that's not working for me.
It's not clicking.
Yeah.
He's played for laughs, and again, just not getting the laughs for me. So, and there's more that I can get into that happens in episode 3 that I had a few issues with, but I will rattle off a few things I think that are kind of working, and I am going to watch to the end because I'm interested in how they wrap, how some of this stuff comes together. And plus, I've read a few headlines that say they didn't spoil anything, but they just said that it gets a little bit more twisty. So I'm interested in seeing how that happens. But a couple of things that are working for me, I do think it is kind of compelling in the, you know, what happens next sort of way, which can be easy to pull off just because you're just dealing with plot and not much else there. But
it's a great piece. Yeah. I think we're asking it to be, I always kind of struggle with that. Am I asking this piece of work to be better than it itself intended to be. You know what I mean? Maybe it's just supposed to be a good page turner where the lessons are kind of right on the surface.
And I'm fine with that. Yeah, I'm fine with that, especially. And I think that could, I think it could fix itself in latter episodes with that. And I'm particularly interested in the Nazis hitman, the American, I think his name is, it's not Trent, but it's like, he's got a name almost like that. Do you remember
the guy who gives the horrifying speech on the the airplane?
That's it. He gives the horrifying, in episode two, he gives a very scary speech on the airplane to the kid with peanut allergies. And he when it goes ahead and asks for peanuts, and you know, that to me right there, those moments are where the show is hitting its stride.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a moment where, you know, I mean, there's people who, there's a reason they're making this now. You know what I mean? It's supposed to interact with the fact that, you know, people feel comfortable enough calling themselves neo-Nazis or white supremacists or whatever, that they gather in public without hoods this time and attempt to cause a little mayhem. And when you hear that ideology, you know, laid out like that, it's pretty uncomfortable to watch.
There's going to be a scene, you'll get to this scene in episode three, where that Nazi leader, she's female, you know, she's a little bit of an older lady. She gives a speech that just echoes all the white nationalist bullshit today. And when the show does those things, when it mirrors what's happening today, and it reminds us that what's happening is not as comedic as they're trying, or action packed as they're trying to make it, I think it's a good show. And when it's not doing those things, it falls flat. So
I think another thing that it does well, if we're talking about good moments, both of the Nazis that have been violently confronted had very different reactions to the allegations being made against them. They both were attempting to survive until the end via any means necessary. The first one in the toy store, very sadistic, ready to, you know, pick up right where he left off, really. And the second one repeats these things that you hear a lot of people say. Well, I was just I'm also a victim because I was a young man and I got caught up in this and blah, blah, blah. And you start to see, I don't know, like we talked about this with different political candidates who make claims about like Joe Biden, his involvement in the civil rights era. You know, there's things that he says that have been proven to be false, but how many times has he told himself those stories? Does he actually believe it now? You know, what have these people convinced themselves of in their relationship to Nazi Germany and the Holocaust? I don't know. That's a very interesting, I don't know how far down that road they'll go, but it's an interesting wrinkle to these encounters.
I think Joe's convinced himself he was there with Moses and brought down the commandments.
I think he probably, yeah, he's definitely thinking about that when he goes to bed at night.
I don't know what Joe thinks about. So yeah, that's Hunters on Amazon Prime. I'm going to finish it. I want to see what happens.
I think I sound more on board than you are.
I think you are. Yeah. I think you, but we'll both finish it. I don't know if we'll retouch anything on related to the show here on the podcast, but those are our thoughts for sure. All right, what else you got to add? Anything on Hunters from Amazon?
No more on Hunters. I think that I'm excited to see how it'll play out. I'd give it a solid B. You know, you make it through two episodes and you kind of decide, am I going to stick with this? And I'm with you. I'm sticking with it.
Okay.
More optimistically than you are.
I'm going to give it a C+.
Fair enough.
So. Yeah,
I don't disagree with any of your criticisms.
Okay, good. I don't feel bad then. let's wrap here, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Folks, that's it for this episode. Thank you for listening. Reach out to us. Say hello. We'll be back in 2 weeks with some more. What do we need to be watching? What do we need to be seeing? Let us know. What music do we need to hear? What books? We'll talk to everyone later. Thanks for joining us.